This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is July 3rd in the year 2001. I'm at 1802 Fordham with Wally Welker, where we're going to continue the interview that we began, a couple of weeks ago, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the Department of Neurophysiology, which was where you were housed throughout your career at the university. Now, originally it was located within the Department of Physiology. Explain how that went.
Yeah. Department of Physiology was one of the main medical school departments for training doctors. And it had been here for eons, you know, many years. Mm-hmm. And neurophysiology was beginning at in the late 40s in the around the country, around the world. And the dean of the medical school, Sam Middleton, I think.
It wasn't Sam. Dean Middleton. I've forgotten his first name now. Dean Middleton.
Yeah, Dean Middleton. He was charged by the president, I think, or the chancellor, to recruit somebody for a special chair to deal just with the area of neurophysiology. And Clinton Woolsey was recommended by the chairman at Johns Hopkins as being a bright, young, neural type guy. He actually had gone into medicine, got his head as MD, and wanted to be a neurosurgeon. So he did a lot of sterile neurosurgery. But then he developed pneumonia, so he was out of circulation for a year, and he decided during that year, I guess he meditated then and decided that he would go into research. But that was his, probably his strong suit. Didn't want to teach. So he was recommended by Philip Bard, chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins, to Littleton here in Wisconsin. And they brought him, and he became the Bascom professor of neurophysiology, I guess. And he started a laboratory. He didn't teach. He started a laboratory and began to recruit researchers, young people, to do neurophysiological work. And the oscilloscope had just been used for recording electrical potentials at that time. And so he went around the East Coast universities to find out what equipment was required. He got the basic amplifiers and oscilloscopes and whatnot to record electrical potentials from the brain, the surface of the brain of animals. And I think he just began some studies that he started some studies here that he had begun at Johns Hopkins to stimulate the brain, to look for movements, to find out where the motor cortex was, cerebral cortex, and to record from the brain or explore around with electrodes to find out where the touch, somatic sensory, the visual and auditory areas were on in cats, monkeys, rats.
Is this called, was that mapping?
That was called mapping, yeah.
Okay.
And he developed a method of portraying the data, which gave one a visual picture of how the retina, for example, was, because they used spheres placed around in front of the eye of a cat, shine a little bright light here, a little bright light there, and the eye would focus those beams on different parts of the retina. So, and then they would activate the brain accordingly in the parts of the brain that were connected from that part of the retina, so that you could map receptor surfaces when they were stimulated, mapped their targets in the cerebral cortex. And they found out there was a pattern to this.
Hmm.
They did the same thing for somatic sensory touch, so that's the touching the fingers and the elbow and the arm and the head, the lips, feet, different parts of the body would activate different parts of different areas of cerebral cortex in the somatic sensory areas of cortex. And so they essentially defined and identified, located where these different sensory areas were on these several different mammals. They decided to do it on a comparative basis, cats, monkeys, rats, to see whether there was a general theme, a plan, in the way that the sensory receptor surfaces were projecting or mapped onto the cerebral cortex. It was mainly cerebral cortex that they were exploring because it's easiest to access. Just take off the skull and open the dura mater and peel it back. And there's the brain, alive, the animals anesthetized. And you then put your electrodes, which are about a millimeter in diameter, connected to all the electrophysiological equipment. And then you would blink some lights or put different frequency tones or clicks in the ear, one ear or the other, or touch the body surfaces with punctate stimuli, and then just laboriously move the electrode around and find out where the potentials were.
Did he, you said that he looked for developing themes. Was he able to develop themes?
In different animals. Yeah, he found that the areas for vision and audition and somatic sensory receptors were differentially placed in relatively similar positions in different animals. Of course, the rat brain is a lot smaller than the cat, and there's more convolutions in the cat and the rat, and more convolutions in the monkey than the cat, so that you had to do some exploring to find out where these areas were. Some of them were buried in cortex, in the fissures. Then he got on to chimpanzees, and so the work was begun with the great apes. So the idea was to aim towards looking for homologs in animals that were present in humans. And so Woolsey also developed a teamwork with the neurosurgeon Erickson here at the medical school, who was looking for epileptic foci in humans so they could excise them and prevent the individuals from having epileptic seizures, either auras or visual flashes or grand mal or whatever. So, and that was the technique at the time to control epilepsy, is to explore and find the areas that were responsive to different sounds or areas that were showing these spiking effects when the individual had a seizure. And then you aspirate it out, you suck out the brain cortex with a suction tube, and the epileptic focus would be eliminated, and persons could be then sewed back up. It was all done sterilely, of course, and the epilepsy would go away.
Really?
So that was a procedure developed in Canada and here and around the world. Different neurosurgeons were using this technique at that time.
Now, you said neurosurgery started to come into its own in the late 50s?
In the late 40s.
Late 40s?
Yeah.
What was the reason for it coming of age at that particular... What was happening out there that made it possible?
That was one of the reasons for going in and removing epileptic foci in cerebral cortex. And the other reason was at the time, at the tail end of the time, when people were doing lobotomies, going in sterilely and severing the frontal lobe, they were experimentally trying a variety of different methods to control psychoses and dementias of various kinds. So But this experimental approach was considered a better way to be more precise, rather than just lobbing off each part of the brain. You try to find just the part that was producing difficulties.
And it sounds as if what Dr. Woolsey was doing was really relatively new at the time. If he had to go out and find, what, oscillators and whatnot to build his own equipment. Is this something, again, this was Johns Hopkins the leader in this area?
Yeah, they were one of the leaders. One of the departments in University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. And I think Yale had some individuals doing work with different universities around the country, mostly on the East Coast. So it was the beginning of a new era in the exploration of the brain with more precise experimental methods.
Were people, the brain just sounds so complex to me. I mean, I don't know where you would start on something like that.
Yeah, well, I think that was the problem. They didn't know. Neuroanatomists had been looking at brain sections and seeing different structures in different areas and seeing fiber tracts coming up from the spinal cord or going back down, and so they were hypothesizing where the different functional areas of the brain were from the time of Gall and Spurzheim. There had been thought they could tell by bumps on the head where what personality features or emotional features or character features were more present in some individuals than others. So there are a lot of speculative theories about what parts of the brain did what and whether the size of the brain made a difference. And very early they learned that brain size was not particularly relevant. It was more the connectivities that made the difference in the determine whether an individual was a poet or a, they were looking to try to find brain explanations for brain sources for some of the gifted people. Mm-hmm. That was being done around the world. And they needed some more experimental methods going in and looking. And so that's where Woolsey was an early pioneer.
So he was really doing the cutting edge stuff of the day.
Yeah. Right.
I want to get back to Woolsey in a lot more detail in a moment, but let's go back to the department for a minute and set the stage a little bit. The department of it's a laboratory of neurophysiology. It wasn't really a department, obviously, till later. How did that? Right. What was it? How did it fit in with physiology?
The dean wanted neurophysiology to be incorporated in the medical school activities, and the logical place was to put it in the Department of Physiology. And so that's where it went, and initially it was called the Laboratory of Neurophysiology. It didn't have it was a separate entity who was responsible only to the dean. Not really under the chairman of the...
Oh, so it was sort of in the department, but not of the department.
But not of the department,
right. Gotcha.
And so there was some personality conflicts there. And Woolsey was assigned to do research and training of researchers. So
assigned by the dean?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the dean insulated him from the departmental and medical school politics. Mm-hmm.
What about, there was a chairman of physiology who was there when Woolsey first came, and he reigned for a fairly long time, Yeomans. Did you work with him at all?
No, I knew him, but he...
How was his relationship with...
I think they were polite, diplomatic, but I don't think they admired one another. And they really didn't have much to do with one another.
Was that because of the fact that neurophysiology was just was conducting research alone, or
that was a point of contention with the other professors in physiology. They thought anybody who came in should be taking part of the teaching load. And Woolsey was not a teacher; he was good at it. He did give lectures about the brain, but they were sort of a little tacked on, and the brain subject wasn't much of a curriculum given to medical students. They dissected the human brain, and they did some neuroanatomy from slides from the anatomy department. But neurophysiology was a new discipline, and so it was being just brought in just to get a foothold in this university.
When you and Benjamin and Hind and some of the others came in, did you have that same, I don't know if I want to call it a problem, that might be too strong, that same, well, I'll call it a problem, with the Department of Physiology?
Yeah, we were immune from departmental politics. We would go to the meetings. We would go to the meetings of the medical school, but we really didn't participate. Woolsey also often did as to have a voice, but he didn't really, and people respected him because he had power.
Yes.
And he had the power of being protected by the dean.
Yes, and he raised a lot of money, too.
Yeah, he raised a lot of money.
Did Woolsey kind of, did he protect you guys from physiology?
Yeah, he did. He found space for us to set up our labs and gave us the freedom to explore. And he assigned us projects, but he didn't have rigid control. Yeah. And usually we would work with him to learn techniques. And then he chose people who were creative and inventive and hard workers. And that's who came and that's who stayed. And I was one of those.
Yeah. It'll come back. When Middleton left, John Z. Bowers became dean of the medical school.
Oh.
Were you here during his tenure?
Yes.
From what I've been able to gather from other people I've interviewed, it was rather there was a lot of controversy that swirled around Bowers. Was that evident to you at all?
No, we knew of it, but we didn't, because we weren't involved in the politics or in the academic operations of the medical school. I personally wasn't interested in it.
Okay.
And I think Woolsey probably knew what was going on, but Benjamin and I were essentially insulated. We didn't care.
Well, you were not only insulated, but you didn't care. So
yeah,
sort
that's
of
right.
the double. The one question I meant to ask you before and slipped my mind is, were you voting members of the medical school?
Yes, we were. But I didn't, nor did Benjamin, take it seriously. I mean, we weren't particularly interested in the issues. Because they didn't affect us.
Okay, so Woolsey would have been the only one who would have been...
Yeah, he was the one that has the voice. He was a strong leader.
Yeah. Yeah. When you came to the campus, in, was it September of 56?
54,
excuse me. What were the facilities like for neurophysiology?
We had a recording set up. We had a room on the third floor of SMI.
SMI is?
Service Memorial Institute.
Service Memorial Institute.
And we had desks up there. Woolsey was on the third floor. Woolsey was on the second floor where his office was. And he had security at the end of that hall, second floor over close to the old hospital. He had a long room which was used as the sterile surgery. And we had an autoclave there to sterilize gowns and caps and stuff like that. And instruments, and surgical instruments. And that's where we did the surgery. And sterile neurosurgery was part of our training. Because one of the ways, once you identified an area as being somatic sensory, say, in an animal, then you could go in and aspirate with a suction tube cortex, and you had to learn how to do this, preserving blood supplies and not injuring adjacent areas, just taking out the part that you wanted, and that you guessed was important for this or that function. And then you slow the animal back up and observe it or test it in some apparatus. And so we did that kind of work.
When you came in 54, was there a surgeon, a chief surgeon, was there someone more or less in charge of the surgical thing? How did you and Bob Benjamin and Joe Hine, how were you trained in that? Who did
just apprenticeship with Woolsey.
With Woolsey.
He was a trained surgeon. And there wasn't any formal method, since we weren't MDs,
mm-hmm.
we were PhDs. We were exempt from the usual routines of training and residency training that young doctors were going through. And they would essentially, if they're going into a surgery, that was especially, if they chose that specialty, they would work with a neurosurgeon mm-hmm. or a heart surgeon or whatever, to learn the methods, learn the sterile techniques. We learned it under Woolsey's supervision, and he was a tough, you know, character. He would make sure we did it correctly, and he wanted to see bloodless surgery, immaculate techniques, and appropriate data recording and things of that kind. So he was a good teacher.
He was tough, but he was good.
Yeah. Very precise, and we learned.
How much surgery did you actually perform? How big a part was that of your activities?
For me, it was quite a bit. I was interested in different animals. Like I connected with the Department of Natural Resources. They had a raccoon breeding mm-hmm. colony up mm-hmm. in Poignet at the State Game Farm, because they were releasing raccoons into the wild to, I guess they were being hunted or whatever, but it was part of the assignment that the legislature had made for that department. And they decided to abandon that program, and so there was a whole mess of raccoons were available. So I went up, got about 60 of them, put them in cages up on the seventh floor of the then Bardeen Laboratories. And I did a lot of animal care mm-hmm. activities.
I'll bet you did.
And I learned how to handle animals, capture them, and anesthetize them, clean them up, and put them into a surgical setup, layout, and drape them with sterile cloths, and provide a little window open to the part of the, you'd shave their hair off their head, say. Then you'd go in, you'd have scalpels and everything laid out on a tray, and you'd perform a sterile surgery. You'd go in and learn how to make a little hole in the skull and pry it out, pry the skull out, the areas that you suspected that had the cortex you were wanting mm-hmm. to get at. And so there was a lot of meticulous procedures there that we had to learn to do, and they were fun, actually.
How long would it take to do, like, a procedure on a raccoon, for example?
Oh, it would take several hours. Mm-hmm. When I ended my career, I did a lot of acute surgical exposures where I would explore. It was then, the latest ones I was working on was the cerebellum, which is a lot more tricky to get at, and back behind the back of the brain, and there's a lot of blood vessels back there. You had to be very careful, and so you had to be very precise, and you had to have all the right instruments. We would make some that were appropriate for pushing the brain out of the way and lifting the skull out, and take the skull away. And at the end of my career, then we would go in and record from the cerebellum and it may have took about 8 hours just to prepare the animal so that it was open. These were not sterile, they were acute, so that afterwards you were going to kill the animal, perfuse it with formalin, and save the brain so you could see where it is your electrodes have gone in. So that most of an entire work day were taken just in preparing the animal for recording. Then you'd spend all night recording.
Well, yeah, you said that you did a lot of, I remember talking to Bob Benjamin, he said there were a lot of long nights.
Long nights.
That once you started something, you couldn't really stop it.
No.
You had to continue through to the
conclusion. A lot of it was just preparation and having it appropriately laid out so that you could then go in and do the things that you really wanted after. Mm-hmm. But you had to be very careful to make sure that you hadn't damaged anything. Yeah. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to record anything.
So there you are at 2 o'clock in the morning, having been up already since 6 the preceding morning, and then you're really getting into the most delicate part of the whole operation.
And when we were recording on chimpanzees, because they're so valuable, you may carry an experiment out for 3 or 4 days. So you'd have different teams of people come in. So Woolsey was recruiting more people by that time, and people, young folks, were really excited to learn these new techniques.
And they were new, right?
They were new. Yeah.
Now you said that sometimes new instruments had to be devised and made.
Yeah.
Is that something you constructed, or did you have someone on staff who would do that?
When the medical science building went up, Woolsey designed our lab spaces, and he created a full-fledged laboratory in which you had photography, you had an art space for someone to draw, make up drawings, and make presentations for showing the data. You had a histology where the brain tissue was embedded and processed and stained and then sliced on a microtome and mounted on slides, so you could, that was essential. Micro and your anatomy is an essential part of the whole business. You just couldn't go in and record. You had to then find out where you were recording and verify it. So we also had an animal care room where animals were brought down from the top floors and prepared. So it was a washdown room with a drain and cages in there. So then we had a micro electrode manufacturing room, which was a small little room where you would shape and prepare electrodes of the kind that you needed for experiments you were recording in. We had a sterile surgery which had an autoclave and a person assigned to it. We had a small shop for someone to create small gadgets to hold an animal or to hold a piece of apparatus or whatever. It was a seminar room. So Woolsey designed the facility so there was something, there were all these service modules.
Yeah.
Histology, electrode manufacture, animal care, photography, art, medical illustration, and we had a seminar room for presenting results. But he masterminded all this to make sure that we had everything contained within our unit, and we didn't have to go outside to have things done. It was all within Woolsey's control.
It sounds like an incredibly large support staff for a relatively small group.
Yeah.
He must have really been bringing in some nice dollars from...
A lot of money was coming in.
Was that NIH money primarily?
Yes. NIH began to build, and there was a lot of money available for all kinds of basic research.
Now, you started out, you said, in the which building?
We started out in SMI.
SMI, so, and you were there when you came in 56, and that was
54.
A little more, or 54 there.
Yeah.
56, I might have 54, and that was a little more basic. It just had that operating room right by Woolsey.
Office space and one recording room and a histology.
And then it was in 1960 that the a medical sciences building. So Woolsey would have been designing it in the years before that. Did he do that pretty much by himself, or were you people involved?
We were involved because we were going to use it. We already had been selected to stay. So Joe Hind and Bob Benjamin and I and a couple others were
ready to go.
Ready to go and to staff the laboratories and do different research projects. Mm-hmm. It was a large auditory group had been developed and a visual receptor group, and I was somatic sensory, and Bob Benjamin studied taste. Mm-hmm. And olfaction. Mm-hmm. So all the basic senses were involved. And we were all involved in electrical stimulation to study motor control areas, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mostly of cerebral cortex.
So it was really with a open. So it was really in 1960 with the opening of the new building that things, that the facilities were there. To
yeah.
support the staff that had been
yeah.
developing. Had he been sort of aiming toward that? Was that?
Yeah, he'd been aiming for it. And the people who were on the academic staff before, previously in SMI, were there to do the various things that they were going to then have little facilities for in the new building. So we had a shop person, we had a histologist.
Is this one, okay. Let's talk a little bit more about Woolsey. Now he studied under Philip Bard, and you gave a little bit of his background there. Do you know anything about pre Johns Hopkins, where he'd done his research?
He went to medical school and he ended up at Johns Hopkins, but I think it'll be in his book. But I think he went to the medical college in Albany, New York. New York Medical College in Albany, and he was where else? He was a couple other places in the East Coast where he did some training. I don't remember the details.
Did he do behavioral work at Hopkins too?
No, he was interested in behavior because he realized that the outcome of brain function was behavioral things and. But he wasn't a behaviorist, so he recruited a lot of behaviorists, however. People who were studying animal behavior in psychology departments or zoology departments.
Now, you talked last time, you did a lot of observational things
yeah.
with your work. What about Woolsey in that capacity? Was he?
He didn't do much of that. He supported what we did, what we wanted to do.
I also heard that he had a penchant for hiring people from different fields.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that at all?
Well, there were several psychologists, but he would people would write asking to come because they were recommended to come work here. And so there were people who had anatomical training, and eventually we had a neuroanatomist on the staff. Mm-hmm. John Barnard was one of the first, and then Conrad Ockert, and then Jersey Rose.
Right. We'll talk about all those gentlemen in a minute, yeah. A very distinguished group there, especially the latter two. And he brought in people from other countries as well, right?
Yeah, there were people who the United States, the UN had set up these educational and areas to try to bring basic medical science into different countries and try to get people from the United States to go to these other countries to recruit people or train people and help other countries set up their neurophysiological areas. It was more than neurophysiology, but that's where Woolsey got involved. So he was on all the big UN UNESCO committees that would take trips over to Russia or Spain or India or China and South America, Chile.
Were there any countries in particular that were really getting big into neurophysiology at the time? Or?
Well, Woolsey had a close relationship with Sam Middleton at the University of Santiago in Chile, Chile in Santiago. And I don't know, he met him in the UN auspices, I think, but they developed a buddy relationship, so they wanted people to come down and help them set up their labs. I went down, one of the fellows from Brazil came up. Young man who came up and worked with me on the largest living rodent, the capybara, and the guinea pig. We did recording studies of somatic sensory, visual, and auditory areas in those animals. And he spent 2 or 3 years here working with me, recording from these sensory areas in these animals, and sort of comparative studies. But the capybara was a resident of Brazil and the Amazon area, and it was the University of Belo Horizonte in the province of the state of Belo Horizonte in Brazil that Gilberto Campos came from. And I don't know how he particularly was chosen, but he was one of the people who applied to come and study. And Woolsey would accept these people and assign them to one of us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And then the Woolsey would promote that we would set up a neurophysiology laboratory down there. Mm. And I had to go through, the United Nations provided the money to buy all the electrophysiological equipment. Mm. And I would order it, and I would arrange for it to get through customs to get to be able to be sent out of the United States down to Brazil. And so those things were all worked out. And under the auspices of the United Nations. And I went down there with this equipment.
Oh my.
And set it up, connected it, and got it working for Gilberto Campos down at the university down there. And that was one of the ways that collaborative work was set up.
That's very interesting. So there were other, perhaps Joe Hind or Bob Benjamin or Woolsey himself would do similar types of things to other,
in other areas.
So this was a major operation. Yeah, I mean, you guys were not only internal, but you were exporting your...
And Woolsey was laying out the master plan for this. This was the way he worked.
Now, when you went down to Brazil, you set up the equipment. Did you train the people on the equipment then, or have you been trained here?
The guy who worked with me, Gilberto Campos,
had been already trained here.
Trained with me, and... we worked together down there to, I don't know how many, we spent 2 or 3 weeks there, and to get things going, and so that's how that worked.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Woolsey would hire his postdocs, people would apply the way you had? It was just sort of, people had heard about Woolsey? Was there a standard method, or was it just a little bit more informal?
The field was becoming sort of hot, neurophysiology
right.
becoming
yeah.
hot. And so professors in various parts of the country would want to find places for their students to go. And so they knew, of course, of Woolsey, and they paved the way for their students to come here. And so that's how the network worked.
And then when they got here, he would assign them
to one of our
earlier groups. Times, he would have trained you.
Yeah.
And
he trained us to his satisfaction.
Then as he trained you, he would let you loose, and he would then say,
we would train,
this is Joe Smith from
yeah.
Work with Wally, and
yeah.
he'll teach you what's going on.
So I had a student from, an MD from India, and one from Chile, and one from Brazil, who would come work with me, one from Germany. And I'd give them the same spiel that Woolsey gave us. You know, you learn the physiology, you learn to do surgery, you learn to take care of handle the animals, you learn to do the neuroanatomy, you learn the whole stuff, the whole business. And we sort of followed that model.
So he just didn't want a pipeline from one or two universities and send their students. He wanted a wide breadth of students with a wide variety of backgrounds and trainings. That's interesting.
He had that international mission.
Which was fairly common in the university at that point, wasn't it, in terms of...
I guess so.
It was starting at that point.
Yeah,
the Ford Foundation came at UW.
That's
and
right.
I know a lot of the bigwigs like Harrington and people like that all had their particular areas that they would travel to.
Yeah.
And develop, so this was kind of fitting in with that whole...
We were a focus, and Woolsey participated in that and fostered it.
Now, one thing that a few people mentioned to me, and you mentioned just in the last 5 minutes, and that's research groups. I've heard that Woolsey had a real strong focus on research groups. Define what exactly a research group was and how it functioned under Woolsey.
Well, there'd be a laboratory with all the equipment.
You had a lab, and then Joe and Bob would share a lab with their similar...
Joe
would have one, Bob would have one.
For auditory, Bob had one for...
So these are different labs
different
at this
labs
point.
In the medical science building.
Okay.
And we developed our own cluster of students, some local, from medical school or from psychology department or zoology, as well as people from outside who were coming to be trained. And Woolsey kept an eye on all this, you know, just to make sure it was being done up to par. He would have seminars every week where people would present their results, so he made sure there was a flow of information and knowledge, and that he understood what was going on and controlled.
And so the flow would be between the research groups.
Yeah,
so these weren't isolated.
No, they weren't isolated groups.
Okay.
They were all working to foster interdisciplinary work. That was big push. Interdisciplinary work, meaning not only the different physiological subspecialties, but also anatomy and, in many cases, behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He supported behavioral studies, Woolsey did, which was perfect for me because I didn't know how I would correlate behavior with brain, but I wanted to dabble in each of them, and so did several others.
So you had the freedom to sort of dabble?
Yeah.
Because of the structure of the
That's
whole
right.
thing? That's no, very
we had
interesting.
We had a fairly liberal space to be able to set up facilities. There was a couple of small rooms that I'd use for behavioral studies, one-way mirrors in which you have an animal and you're recording from it, but you'd also be electrophysiologically, but you'd be observing it and setting up apparatus for it to do things of that kind. Behavioral studies were becoming common everywhere in animals. To parse out the details of behavioral repertoires, and that was going on in psychology, zoology, ecology, ethology, all evolved at this time. We're trying to understand how animals behaved and what their repertoires were and why the repertoires were as they were. Why the animals chose or acted as he did in different environments. And full understanding of an animal's capacities and behaviors.
Hmm. That must have been very exciting. I mean,
very exciting.
A lot of this stuff was going on for the first time.
First time.
You were studying all different areas, the senses, as you said.
It was a great ferment, and all of us felt we were very lucky. to be doing these things and having the money to do it. Money kept flowing.
And when Woolsey got busier, when you people moved into the new building, then he didn't have his own research groups anymore?
He had his own research groups.
Oh, he did have his own research.
He continued.
Oh, he continued that, okay.
Continued either, mostly in visual things, visual studies. So he sort of, Joe Hind was masterminding the auditory stuff at that time. Auditory, Joe was a master acoustic technician and understanding acoustic waves and how the ear receives them and how they're transmitted into the brain and so forth. So the auditory groups became multiple for doing different explorations of. We had to do surgical exposures of the ear, the inner ear, and the basilar membrane of the ear, and get inside to look at the cochlear nuclei and auditory nerves and medullary brainstem centers that were connected to the ear. Very, very complicated system audition, much more complicated than vision or... Because of the time intervals are more precise, that the way we perceive sound and localize and identify frequencies and is a much more demanding problem for the nervous system to solve. Comparing timings between one ear and the other and brain centers that would compare inputs and intensities and frequencies, so that you had all these different parameters of the acoustic signals that had to be disentangled and understood and reassembled and then interpreted by a series of auditory stations all throughout the brain. So. We became a major center. We still are for study of auditory.
Now that was your biggest area. You had the most people in there. The auditory.
Most people were
Who was working on that in the early years besides Joe?
Bill Rohde, R-H-O-D-E. He's still here. He developed methods for studying movement of the inner ear structures that were using a laser beam to measure these micron displacements of the ear is a very complicated structure, and it had to be understood. There were a lot of auditory groups around the country evolved at that time. Some of them doing more specialized work than others. And, our people got into the auditory nuclei of the brainstem mostly.
What about now? You said Bob Benjamin was doing vision.
He was doing taste.
Taste
and smell.
Taste and smell. Sorry. Could you talk just a little bit about him and his work?
He was trained by Carl Pfaffman on East Coast University. Can't grab it right at the moment, but. And he was sent out because he knew Woolsey, and he knew Woolsey would set him up, allow him to explore taste structures of the brain, and that's what he did. Taste bud arrangements in the tongue are very specialized and peculiar. And the areas of the brain that interpret signals from taste are quite small and very localized. The brainstem and the thalamus and the cortex were very difficult because they were small, they were difficult to find. So Benjamin had a real decipherment task. It was easier for me to study touch and somatic sensory because the whole body involves those sensory receptors. And they're easy to find. And Benjamin was very specialized. He had developed very elaborate equipment for delivering different chemicals to the tongue. It's not a precise delivery system as it is for touch, where you can just do tick, 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 tick. But acid and sweet, different tastes had to be applied to a rather amorphous sensory surface on the tongue. And finding the areas of the brain was equally difficult because they were sufficiently small and unexplored. So, whereas the synaptic sensory areas were large, the visual areas were large, the auditory areas were pretty large, it was easier to find them in the first place.
So it's just locating them alone is extremely difficult.
So one of the major subjects of our entire department was localization of functions.
Oh my goodness. So we're really talking square one stuff here.
Yeah.
I mean, you're figuring out where it is that you have to go to begin your...
And you start with the sensory systems or the motor systems because they're the most obvious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, I got to get more solar.
When people like when Benjamin is doing his work, is he in touch with people around the United States who are doing similar work?
Yeah.
Is there a network going on?
Yeah. The Physiological Society was one of the first societies that we joined, and they'd have annual meetings or semi-annual meetings or regional meetings. You would go to those. Wolseley encouraged us to do that. He provided the travel money.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd also like us to present, because he'd like to have his work, his people, visible. And they were interesting, because there was a lot of physiology, heart physiology or kidney physiology, that we were interested in, but there was always a nucleus of a small group of neuro people. In the beginning, all the people, important people in the world, could have been in a room this size.
Wow.
It was exciting. Yeah. I mean, we didn't realize till later what we were part of. And then later, you developed specialized societies for different topics. So you had auditory physiology would have their meetings. And now they meet in Florida every spring, and the visual people would meet somewhere else, and neuroanatomists would meet somewhere else, but the neuroanatomical societies, the Society for Neuroscience began along that time, and their national meetings became larger and larger. They're now one of the largest societies.
Oh my goodness.
Like 30,000 people will go to those meetings.
Wouldn't fit in this room.
I don't go anymore, but I did for a long time.
Did Wolsey, would Wolsey attend those meetings occasionally, the more specialized ones?
Yes. Yeah, he did. He always made sure we went.
Mm-hmm.
That was good, just to hear other people and to meet other people. Meet people working in your same area.
Oh yes, yeah. Especially these very specialized developing areas where you're learning something new probably every week.
And there was always equipment being displayed by the
vendors.
Vendors. Yeah.
I'm trying to get a sense of Wolsey's position in all this. In terms of neurophysiologists nationally or internationally, was he considered one of the top ones? I mean, was he right at the top of the...
Yeah, he was. He was on all the NIH committees and was responsible for... He was on the Sister Kenny Foundation board and other boards of that kind where they were dealing with neurological diseases when he had been recruited for those specialized diseases. he was one of the people who would be chosen to represent neurophysiology.
Were there any other neurophysiologists, I'm again trying to just get a sense of the field, who had the status of Woolsey when he was in his real prime?
Yes. The people in Canada, they were, it'd be a little harder for me to get the names out, but
no. Again, I'm not as interested in the specific people as I am in just kind of his place in the pecking order here.
He was one of the major people, and for a long time, until the younger set mm-hmm. came along, and then a lot of them didn't even know who Woolsey was.
Yeah.
But he's
the Young Turks.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
sort of inevitable, though, in every field, isn't it?
I think so.
The new group comes along, and
well, his methods—he still used a lot of the old methods, and they were superseded by modern.
Tell me what you mean by old methods.
Well, he used simple wires placed upon the surface of the brain, and later microelectrodes were developed in which you went into depth, pierced into the brain, and got into hidden tissues. And, it required learning more about electrophysiological and the basics of the equipment, and Woolsey didn't have that interest or the time, and he was mostly into administration. He, he became a member of the, very early, a member of the National Academy of Sciences.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
He's one of the few people at this university who were elected to that. And so he always went to those meetings. There were surgical societies meetings he would go to, neurosurgical groups. But he was a major player around the world,
yeah.
And so he would go to the international meetings.
Did he publish anything that that he's sort of known for? This is Woolsey's definitive.
Well, the early work on localization of function of somatic sensory motor, visual auditory areas. They all grew so quickly that his methodologies were superseded by fast-growing new techniques, and so he saw this happening, and so he receded into the administration and played a role in the university and make sure that the Weissman Center, say, was set up, and for mental retardation. He was in all those national committees that, I don't know if there's 13, 14 mental retardation centers that were sponsored by the...
That was during the Kennedy years.
Yeah.
That was very popular, yeah.
And he was on all those major committees. And
was he, you said he was a good administrator?
I think so. He liked to have everything under his control. So he wanted things to be run the way he wanted them to be run, so that's why he made his own domain, so he could control everything. And he had a strong voice in committees. People knew that he was bringing in huge amounts of money to
On campus committees?
Yeah.
So he was a university citizen as well?
Yes.
Just a member of
he was. And he was acknowledged for this, and he would hobnob with all the president and the chancellor and all those folks.
Now, I read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, that when Woolsey retired, I think it was in the mid to late 70s, something like that, that he continued to work on his mapping?
Yeah, he had all this data he'd collected that he never published. He always published little abstracts, you know, that give the essence of something, but he didn't. He he was always on to something else, or he had new students to take care of, or he had committees or other institutional matters that societal matters, social, you know, professional society matters that took his time, and he just didn't have time to publish everything. But he had huge quantities of data sitting around that he never published.
Interesting.
He published them usually as abstracts, but his reputation was so great that people knew what he was doing. And
yeah, some people don't have to publish as much as others, right, do they?
I don't know how many total papers he had. He had quite a fair number, I'm sure. But,
tell me, one more question on Woolsey, and then I have a few other people I want to talk about. What kind of a person was he? When you went to the when you met him on the street, or when you went over to his house for dinner or something like that, what kind of person was he outside of the lab and outside of the formal world of
He was formal. He always wore a tie and a suit at work as well as at home, and he always was friendly and kind. I mean, he'd always greet you and recognize you, and but he wasn't one for small talk, or he was a facilitator of people who were serious-minded to meet together.
Was he married?
Yes.
What about Mrs. Woolsey?
Mrs. Woolsey played a wife's role. She took care of the opened their house to students. They invited people invited all of us to dinner. From time to time, they'd have
So from time to time, he'd invite you all over for parties?
Yeah. His wife was a very gracious, friendly person. She knew everybody in the department and the university. She was a nurse, I think. He met her at
her marriage. Sense,
she was a nurse at Johns Hopkins. He had a modest home on the west side of Madison, and they raised three sons, one of which is a major figure in neurophysiology, ear anatomy.
Where does he...
He's at St. Louis. What's the name of that?
WashU, Washington University.
Yeah, I think that's it. And he's a professor there. He's been a major figure in the Society for Neuroscience and editor of some of the major journals. He's similar to his father in many ways, not only in physiognomy but style. And a genetic similarity, I think. But he's also a very nice man, and been a great teacher, very humble. Woolsey was humble, never bragged or promoted himself.
So he was sort of formal in the period. I mean, he, more or less in keeping with the period in a lot of sense.
That's right, yeah.
Did he ever, to your knowledge, did he ever get any other job offers or entertain any entertain leaving the university? So, are you aware of him getting any other job offers?
No, I think he had, I don't know what he was earning here, except I remember after he retired, some new people were being hired who were being paid more than he was paid at the end of his career.
Oh my. It's funny how that goes sometimes.
Yeah.
I guess funny isn't the word, but
But I think he was well respected. He had a solid niche here, and he could do anything he wanted. And he was identified with this university. He may have had some other job offers in the beginning, but yeah. I think he took this one. That satisfied him.
Well, he had a pretty nice career here, actually.
Yeah, he did.
I'd like to talk about one other string of people that you mentioned before, and that's the John Barnard, Conrad Akert, Jersey Rose. Those are the neuroanatomists.
Neuroanatomists. Yeah.
Now, as I understand it, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Rose scheduled to initially come here with Woolsey, and then he couldn't because of his wife took another job. I can't remember exactly what.
I forget the details about that, but he was at Johns Hopkins,
right.
And they knew each other and they were good friends. They respected each other highly.
Yeah.
Rose was trained by his uncle, Maximilian Rose, who was a famous neuroanatomist. Jersey Rose was very meticulous. And
Wait, excuse me, that was poorly asked on my part. Before we get to Rose, let's talk about John Barnard. Now, was he on staff when Woolsey came?
He was in the Department of
Physiology,
okay. I think, and he died of a heart attack too far down the road, and so I didn't know him very
well. So he left simply because he died?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Conrad Akert.
Akert.
Tell me a little bit about him.
He was Swiss-born and lived in Zurich, but he came here as a resident or as a postdoctoral trainee at Johns Hopkins, I think. Woolsey brought him here. I think Rose was not available for some reason or other.
Right.
And but Akert was hired, and he may have been hired partly by the anatomy department here, but because he taught in anatomy. But he was a very strong European character who I liked him. We wrote a couple papers together, but on methods. He was a hard taskmaster, and he ran the histology lab for setting up methods for doing good solid histochemistry of nervous tissue. And developed standardized techniques. He was very meticulous and careful, very strong-willed, and I think he and Woolsey didn't necessarily get along very well.
Where was it? Two strong-willed people?
Two strong-willed people,
in the beds, yeah.
And Akert would not hesitate to state his views and was easily incensed or
quick to temper.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Did he do teaching?
He did teaching here, yeah, in neuroanatomy.
Now, how come, is that because that position was more in physiology that the teaching would accompany?
Well, he might have been part of the anatomy department.
I think I did hear that somewhere.
But he had his office in the neurophysiology group when we were in SMI.
Now, do I recall correctly, didn't you say last time that one of the things you were looking forward to upon coming to Wisconsin was learning more about anatomy?
Yes.
Did you say that?
Yeah.
Did Akert help you in that area?
He did, but he wasn't here at the time.
Oh, he wasn't. Okay, so you would have been...
At that time, I was more interested in behavioral things.
Okay.
I was aware of the importance of neuroanatomy. I'd expected that I would get into it here, but Akert wasn't here, and I don't remember Barnard very well. Either I didn't. He died shortly.
Yeah, I don't think he was here for. I think it was only a couple of years.
Yeah.
So you would have probably been just getting acclimated to the
right
environment. What happened to Akert eventually?
Well, Woolsey really wanted Jersey Rose. Because
mm-hmm.
they were compatible, simpatico. And so when the medical science building was put up, it was planned with an office for Jersey Rose. And that he would be the one who occupied that position. And so I don't know how this worked, but somehow Ockert was eased out. And I think there was some controversy there.
Was he eased out of the university? Or
no, out of the department, out of the neural group. Then he became, I think that's when he became a full-time member of the anatomy department.
Okay.
And so he became, he had an office over there in Bardeen Labs. But it was clear to Bob Benjamin and I that Ockert was a little miffed that he was overlooked.
Did you ever talk to him about it, or is it just that
no.
you had that feeling from
no,
watching?
No, I just had that feeling.
Yeah.
So maybe something was said, but it was clear to us that Clint Woolsey wanted Jersey Rose. They had a strong alliance before, so.
So you said that Rose's had come from a family of neuro, or his father had been a
his
uncle rather had been a
neurologist. I don't know much about his early history, but I think his wife was a professor in Johns Hopkins or the school system in Baltimore or something like that. So that was part of the reason they didn't come right away. Also, Woolsey had to create this place for Jersey Rose. But after he did, Jersey Rose came right off. And he partook of the activities of the auditory group because he's the one who really put the auditory nervous system, the neural anatomy of the auditory nervous system on the map. He would not, he was so meticulous about your anatomical structure. He had written some pioneering papers about how the thalamus developed out of from embryonic clusters of neurons into all the auditory structures that exist in the adult. He studied the developing rabbit embryo brain and could trace the migration of neurons from here to there. And he was, I think he must have had he was a brilliant guy. He was not only he knew world literature, but he knew politics, and he would argue on any subject. He liked disputation. But he also...
Would he take either side on an argument?
Yeah, he would. But he knew neural anatomy inside out, and so you couldn't... Everybody turned to him for guidance. And he knew the neural anatomy of the brain in great detail.
So he was definitely a very strong addition to the...
Very strong addition. And he didn't play a big role in faculty meetings, in your physiology faculty meetings, or a dominant role as a person in the department. Woolsey played that role.
Mm-hmm.
Jersey was there as a...
So you were saying before the phone, you said that Woolsey played the dominant role in faculty meetings, but Jersey was there as for what?
He was there as the wise man in the neuroscience.
Yeah, you had said something about him being a philosopher in a sense.
Yes, he was a philosopher, and he would discuss any topic. He'd listen to anything anyone wanted to say about a problem, an issue, or theory, and he would consider it. He would respect your, whatever you said, but he would be very, if you had a viewpoint and he disagreed with it, he would let you know and he'd tell you why. He explained it in great detail. So most people came to talk to him about near anatomy or to argue with him about brain structure or function. Jersey loved those arguments. Some students were just up to that. I never did have any of those discussions with him. He respected what I was publishing and told me so in, you know, in cryptic ways, but he was a very modest man. He never talked about his own self or his own work. He wrote a number of papers with Clint Woolsey about the brain anatomy and the functional localization of different functions in the brain structures. And Woolsey deferred to him in all anatomical matters.
Oh, really?
Yep. His participation in the staff meetings was as a silent observer, and if he had any comments, he might make them to the assembled staff, but more likely he talked to Woolsey about them afterwards and give Woolsey the benefit of his advice. So everyone respected him, and they cowered before him. If he ever got up to ask a question, that when someone gave a talk in a seminar, people in Jersey, what roses in the audience, they were very cautious about what they said and how they said it, because they knew if he were to get up, and he could lambaste them, and he wouldn't hesitate to do it.
Did he? How long did he remain in the department?
Until his retirement.
Now, he has since died, has he not?
Yeah, he did. I don't know what he died of, but he became more and more feeble and impaired. Nobody ever got a record of his history, did they?
No. Mm-mm. Very unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah, he must have died in like the mid-80s or something.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. One person that one of the sort of old-timers, I guess, the people who came early on, and he came shortly after you, that we haven't talked about, is Dan Geisler. Could you just talk about him for a couple moments, please?
He was part-time in the electrical engineering department at the university. Mm-hmm. That was one of his fortes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so he was hired in that capacity to advise on the setting up of all the equipment to perform electrical decision making that was required for electrophysiological recording. Required someone like that who had a very precise mind, very sharp. Dan Geisler was such a person. He since he retired, he published a book on electrophysiology of the auditory system. Hmm. It's a recent book, I think last year or the year before. But he always participated in the auditory experiments. I think he actually did some of the surgeries and participated in all the group recording sessions where he always had something to contribute to problems that came up, requiring judgment about how to present stimuli and electrically, acoustically, and to look for errors in equipment, production of sounds that were due to equipment problems.
So he was almost like a member of the technical staff in a sense.
Yeah.
But he also had the
background
and the learning those surgery and things like that.
Right. And the knowledge
of the auditory
electrophysiology.
A very handy person to have, I would imagine.
Yeah, and a very funny man. He always was very lighthearted. He never took offense or gave offense, and he was. I've always liked him because he was always interesting to talk to, talk about anything, and never was very opinionated. He had strong opinions. He kept them to himself, and he tried to understand what other people were concerned with. But he stayed almost entirely within the auditory group. They were in the basement of Medical Science Building, so often that group didn't have much contact with the rest of us except during our weekly seminars. And after Joe Hine became chairman, Joe and I, because we were such a big spread out department, you know, over in the Weissman Center and different floors of this medical science building, Joe Hind and I decided to have what we called neuro feasts. We would devote one month, usually during the work day, and Carol, my wife, and I would do the main cooking, and we'd cook up main dishes. Everyone else in the department, the histologists and the other staff or other faculty people, would bring in this and that, potato chips or carrots, and we'd end up with a huge layout, like a party. And it was a time when everyone would, it turned out to be the best way to get people to relax, not talk about work, and to, yeah, that's what we were aiming for, is getting some collegiality, conviviality. We didn't serve drinks, we just had food and beverages. And that turned out to be very successful. We promote them as Nero feasts.
That's great.
And
it sounds as if the there was a nice feeling in the department.
A great spirit goer, and it was partly because everyone were good friends, and we had these weekly seminar meetings where everyone was encouraged to come. Woolsey set the standard for that way at the beginning. And Joe Hind facilitated it. I remember when everyone was smoking, we'd go around and put ashtrays in every other chair in the seminar. And I would call everybody, when we had these neuro feasts, I would call everybody specifically to make sure they came. And and most of them did. They'd line up outside the door of the seminar room, pick up their paper plates and come in and go down the line and gather their food. And The room became very lively and
that's great.
Friendly. And then the histologists and Carol and I and a few others would clean up afterwards.
Well, the other thing is, you guys were, this sort of reminds me a lot about what's happening today. I'm talking about in the year 2001. This was very exciting stuff going on. It's sort of like, almost like the Human Genome Project that was just completed last year, except we're talking about mapping the brain.
Yeah.
And again, you can't help but bond when you guys are up all night or working goofy, probably getting kind of goofy after about 36 hours together. That must have all made for a very exciting, though exhausting.
It did. And I think people were excited, like you say,
right,
by being involved. Often, like in the wee hours in the morning, we'd get worn out at 2 a.m. usually. We'd go over the hill and down to the lake and jump in the lake and swim and come back and finish the experiment.
Oh, if that isn't a bond-building experience, I don't know what is. That's great.
Well, we did a lot of stuff like that. In the drinking days that were at the end of the experiment, you'd go to the bar. I usually couldn't go to sleep when I came home. Mm-hmm. Like at 4, 5, 6 in the morning, I'd take a shower. I was too animated, too excited. Yeah, those are great times. I went into the lab Sunday to look. Some students who needed some space to work, and I still have a large basement mm-hmm. space that where a lot of my junk is. And so Carol and I went in to see where we could make space for them. And it was sort of depressing in a way. I mean, the excitement of the old days mm-hmm. came back to you, but you realize that it's all gone.
Yeah, it's just not there anymore, is it?
I've got to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
The thing I was just talking about, these neurofeasts, carried over the group solidarity thing that was something that Woolsey set up. Mm-hmm. And he and his wife invited us to their house every month for a party, or they invite us for a dinner at different times, a few of us. We had picnics in the summer. The whole department, and Woolsey tried to make sure we had seminar meetings every week.
Was that what was called the Sherrington Club?
Yeah, the Sherrington Society.
The Society.
And initially they were just every month, and he tried to get people from psychology and zoology and other departments who had been interested in allied things related to the brain, get people together, and people hated it. They wanted to, you'd often hold them on Saturday morning. You know? but we went, and in retrospect, when Woolsey retired and Joe Hine and I decided we needed something to keep that spirit going, we invented the Neurofeasts. We were essentially carrying on Woolsey's tradition mm-hmm. that he and his wife had fostered. And it was just wonderful.
That's great. Now, you mentioned Joe Hine and you after Woolsey retired. Talk a little bit, didn't Woolsey form the Department of Neurophysiology or help bring that about
yes.
shortly before his retirement?
Yes, he
Talk
wanted
about that for a moment, will you?
Woolsey wanted to make sure that the entity that he had developed would persist, it wouldn't just disappear like it now has. Mm-hmm. So he had the know-how and the power to make sure that we were voted by the Faculty Senate to be a department. Yeah. And he engineered that.
That's not an easy thing to do.
No,
it's interesting to know how he pulled that one off.
I don't know how he did it, but he had enough power to do it. And that sort of made him feel like there was going to be some continuity. So when Joe Hine took over, we were a department.
Yeah.
And
Joe Hine took over as chairman.
Yeah. Yeah. And Joe Hine worked in the background. He didn't really participate. He attended the auditory experiments. But he spent so much time just making sure the books were straight.
Mm-hmm. And so he was a good technician. He didn't have Woolsey's strength of just sheer magnitude.
No, I think Joe welcomed my enthusiasm for trying to maintain a spirit, you know, for the group, and he supported that fully, and together we made sure that it isn't. It's only in retrospect that I realized that what he had done is to promulgate whatever Woolsey had set up.
So you remained as a department. That was in what, about the mid to late 70s?
Yeah.
And then you remained that way until about 1990. Did it operate at that nice level that you and Joe got it going at?
Well, it did until I retired, and then.
Which was in?
I think it was 91 or 2. But all this group stuff stopped,
mm-hmm.
except the oratory group. The oratory group was coherent, and they had a common purpose, but they were not particularly interested in fostering everyone else to. And where Joe and I would recruit everybody to come, the staff. The histologists, the shop people, we included everybody as part of the team. They were indeed part of the team, in our view. And but after I retired, the enthusiasm and the motive power for that sort of disappeared. And the department was sort of broken up by pieces. John Brugge took over as chairman, and there wasn't enough money to pay for the photographer, so we had to.
So that nice little support staff that Clint
Woolsey
began to dissipate.
Actually, John Brugge found places for them in the medical school, so that they're over there. The histologists kept on, but they your physiology group did not have enough work to keep them going, so they began to take outside work, and because they had a nice facility, they were able to keep the money flow. So there was more concern with the bottom line to make sure everything was being paid for. Woolsey made sure that it all worked because he made sure there was enough money available, whereas everything got much more tight as the years went on. And
so you were sort of, the department then was put back into the Department of Physiology,
essentially,
wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Resorbed.
So it sort of began where it's a cyclical tale here,
yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah, it's a...
You started out within there, and then Woolsey came and he pulled you away.
Yep.
And then... So Woolsey came and kind of pulled you out of that department and formed your own lab or whatever you called it, and then you and Joe and some of the others kind of, after Woolsey left, you kept it going in that direction because you had understood his, you know, what he had done and how important that had been in terms of building a unit.
Right.
And then it just started to break away and form into things that...
And Donato Hertel took the chairmanship after John Brugge, and she didn't have the character of the... nothing against her, it's just that she just didn't have that ability to do what Woolsey or Joe Hine were able to do, or
well,
the desire.
Times changed too.
Yeah, they changed a lot, and I think Rick Moss had this department working smoothly, and he runs it, does his own research, and manages it very well, and so he. He was a beneficiary of all these other groups. And nobody in the other groups, oratory group or my group, were interested in administration or, you know, even Donato Hertel did not have the desire to do that kind of stuff. The philosophy wasn't there.
What do you see as the future of the department?
Of physiology?
Of neurophysiology.
Neurophysiology.
within Xanadu? Or is that just impossible to tell?
That's impossible for me to tell. I lost interest as it all began to fall apart, because I never had the talent or the desire to administrative things. Because I knew the whole history, I probably was best situated to do it, but didn't have the stamina.
So you were fortunate enough to be there during the golden years.
The golden years
of the department.
Yep.
It would be interesting to talk to some of the new people, as you said earlier, and see what their what they know about that.
What they view. I have a feeling that it'll all be lost. Tom Woolsey's son, was here during that whole period as a young boy and as a young graduate of medical school. He went back to Johns Hopkins and got his medical degree, but he came and worked here for a summer or two, or a year or two. He knows the whole history, of course. He was in the family. And more than anyone else, he's probably the best one who could tell the history.
That would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe I could work something out on that.
So. Yeah, that would be worthwhile. Because essentially the department is gone and its visibility is beneath the waves. So it's rather sad for those of us who have watched it happen. I've been here, I was talking to Bob Benjamin, and I haven't talked with Joe Hind recently. He tends to be less judgmental than Bob or I were about feeling sad about it. Joe would see the optimistic side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Joe is a really very gentle person, isn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, I think that why don't we call it a day for today, and we'll pick up, I think, one more session to just about do it.
Okay.
I call this, as we say in showbiz, a wrap.
A wrap, okay.
W-R-A-P. See you.